Thanks for listening to A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins, in partnership with Briefcase News, the service that brings intelligent curation and analysis to your media monitoring. So welcome back to our series looking at fallen angels. Now, in this series, we're looking at famous or iconic companies that failed or simply disappeared. Why did it happen? What did it mean? And could things have turned out differently? Today, we're looking at another fallen icon of British industry, GEC, an electrical giant that once employed a quarter of a million people, making everything from light bulbs and domestic appliances to telephone switchgear and railway trains. Today, it's a small private company called Telent, which provides support services to telecoms firms and employs just 2,000. When we looked last week at ICI, we concluded that while it was in some ways sad what happened, there was at least the upside of the successful emergence of AstraZeneca, now one of the world's biggest pharmaceutical firms. Also, Britain continued to make basic chemicals just under the private ownership of INEOS, a company created by the entrepreneur Jim Radcliffe. So apart from a few specialist capabilities which did go, we concluded it was hard to see anything really critical being lost in the way of industrial capacity that wouldn't have gone anyway. But what's the judgment with GEC? And once again, we're very pleased to be joined by Nicholas Comfort, a writer, a historian of British industrial decline. Let's talk about GEC. You know, would your judgment be different about the GEC situation as opposed to ICI?
I think it would be very different because right up to the mid-1990s, GEC was a £35 billion company exporting £2 billion worth of goods a year. And in the space of a decade, it simply evaporated.
Well, before we get into the details, perhaps we should explain a little bit about what GEC was, why it was important, and a bit about the people who ran it. If you look into the history books, you go right back to the 1880s when the electrical industry was starting in Europe and find it was set up by a man called Gustav Binswanger, who was a German-Jewish immigrant. After a few years under the name Binswangers, it decided to change it to General Electric Company, and that's what GEC became. Perhaps we should leap forward a bit. What's your impression of what GEC's position was in the industrial firmament, Nick, and how it developed over the years?
Well, it gradually increased its capacity and its range. And in the 1920s, the government consciously backed it as, if you like, a counterpart to Germany's Siemens to provide the same kinds of heavy electrical equipment across the Commonwealth as Siemens was doing on the continent, although Siemens had always had some presence in Britain. And this continued up through the Second World War, during which it had a number of important research roles, not least connection with radar. During the post-war period, which time it was half the size of Siemens and therefore still a pretty substantial company, it made various acquisitions and gradually became the dominant force.
Yes, and a lot of those acquisitions came under an individual who I personally never met, but maybe you met, Neil, a man called Arnold Weinstock, whose name is very much intertwined with that of GEC. He started off working in the property industry in the post-war period, but then got married to the daughter of a prominent radio manufacturer and basically, having married the boss's daughter, went to work for the company. This company called Radio and Allied Industries then did merge with GEC, and by that route of marriage and then acquisition, Weinstock ended up on top of the company, where he stayed for a very long time until 1996. Did you know Weinstock, Neil?
I did, not well, but I met him a few times. When I was quite a junior reporter, I went to have an interview with him in his office in Stanhope Gate in Mayfair. And he was there on his own in very subdued lighting with some sort of screen in front of him. But this was his sort of holy of holies where he ran the empire from. And he ran it from what today would be called a spreadsheet, but what in those days was just a series of often daily reports from various parts of the empire that he kept an extremely close eye on, a particular eye on the cash.
Yes. I suppose, Nick, Weinstock would be what we would refer to these days as a manager of an industrial conglomerate, in that he wasn't himself particularly interested in what was being produced in the various factories. He basically ran it as a set of companies and set them financial targets. And as long as they fulfilled them, he was happy. And if they didn't, he went to work with his hatchet. Is that a fair description?
I think it implies a rather greater degree of detachment than actually okay. Applied. I think Weinstock knew exactly what his factories were producing. What he did do was pull together GEC, English Electric, AEI into a single company which dominated that particular sector. And then as times changed, he sold off the bits that turned out not to be competitive, such as Hotpoint.
Which happened in the 90s. But I suppose it's worth just reflecting on the huge size of GEC after he essentially merges together all the major companies in the British electrical industries. I mean, in the 1968, when he buys English Electric, which is the last of them, he's got a business which is employing roughly 230,000 people, which is absolutely enormous in modern terms.
Yes, he got that down to 170,000 fairly quickly.
Yeah.
I was starting off as a reporter in Sheffield when AEI was taken over by GEC, and very quickly the AEI plant was sold. And he made the most of the premises he had, and he was not a man who ever wasted money on anything.
No, and by the mid-1970s, when he gets there, he's gone to work on reducing the size of the business he's taken over. He's known in the press as Britain's biggest unemployer.
He had this reputation of cutting down to size and firing people. But I remember when he took over Avery's, the weighing machine business, which was supposed to be a very sophisticated little business. And I remember him saying that actually, basically, their technology was completely useless and they had to reinvent it completely for GEC. And I suspect that that wasn't an isolated example. There was a lot of businesses which looked quite good on the outside, but actually were not really fit for any sort of long-term purpose.
He goes through this phase in the 1960s of doing a lot of takeovers, including in those days rather unusual things like hostile takeover bids. And then he becomes known really for just sort of rather cautiously sitting on a mountain of cash, rather like the sort of dragon in The Hobbit. Is that a fair description?
I think it probably is. I mean, Neil and I were sitting in the same editorial meetings at the time when there was concern building in the city about, you know, why doesn't Arnie give this money back to the shareholders or go and make some acquisition or simply do something with it? And this pressure built. He then, I think, recognises that the business needs to evolve. And so you have these massive joint ventures, GEC Alstom, of which was the biggest with the French, when the power equipment side, the train building side, is merged into a slightly larger French company. And of course, you then have half a dozen British directors sitting in Paris not being listened to. And there's a moment, there's a crisis, there are huge redundancies in Britain.
I think it was slightly unfair to say, why didn't you give the money back to the shareholders? Because in those days, the rules made it extremely difficult to do so.
I agree.
Except with a very tax inefficient dividend payment. I wouldn't wish to be an apologist for him, but his response was always he couldn't see anything that was worth buying. And given the history of some of the things they did actually buy, this was probably quite a sensible decision.
But do you think sitting on piles of cash or paying large dividends or even making acquisitions aren't the only choices available to a chief executive? One of the sort of vague criticisms one picks up is the idea that, you know, these were businesses which had, if you like, built themselves up in the first half of the 20th century by researching and developing new technologies. And that wasn't really what they were doing in the late 20th century under Arnold Weinstock. Do you think he didn't spend enough on research?
As with ICI, when we were talking about them, the pace of innovation inside GEC slowed. It didn't slow as dramatically as it had at ICI. They were still coming up with new and competitive things. At one point, they were actually pressing British Telecom to modernise the telephone system faster than it wanted to. But you had a situation where it had established businesses. Like ICI, it didn't really get involved in Europe to any great extent, though it wasn't helped by the primacy of Siemens. And in fact, by the latter Weinstock years, Siemens was six times the size of GEC instead of twice as big. And so it wasn't entirely competing internationally, and yet it still had these very large exports. Yes, I think it became a company that was associated with slightly older technologies.
I would add to that, it was in the wrong markets, essentially. It wasn't in the major markets of Europe or indeed America in any meaningful way. And the old Commonwealth was not going to be where the new technology was going to emerge.
Yeah. I mean, the other criticism, I suppose, is that he was always very close to businesses which were associated with government budgets, whether it was British Telecom before its privatisation, or indeed the defence industry, in which, you know, GEC became a very big player. Do you think that was a mistake, really, I suppose?
I think it's a fair comment. Aligning yourself too closely to government at a time when government is spending less is obviously not going to be a very healthy situation. Hmm. I think there is possibly a strong case to be made that in its latter years, GEC under Weinstock didn't look hard enough at where it was going to be if it carried on with the markets it had got.
Well, I want to come back for a second to the thing you mentioned about the joint ventures, which in the last years, and then we'll come on to the Götterdämmerung of life under George Simpson, his successor. But in the 80s, when he started putting together things like GEC Alstom or another one, which was called GEC Plessy Telecommunications, which became a joint venture with Siemens, the logic there was that he was very focused on the idea that he didn't want to be the subject of a takeover bid. The thinking was that by wrapping the group's major businesses up in these complicated joint ventures, with presumably some sort of change of control provision, it would make it extremely unattractive to anyone to take a pop at GEC. As you've suggested, that strategy had certain unintended consequences, certainly in the case of the French deal, which is that it ended up with simply control being completely lost to the French.
Well, yes, as in so many other cases, if you go into a joint venture as the junior partner with a continental company, the moment cuts are made, there'll be cuts at your end. Alstom, ironically, was originally a subsidiary of a British company, British Thomson Houston in Alsace, rather as Macquarie in America was originally Hill Samuel Australia and far outlasted the parent company. The same happened there, but it was in bed with the French government. The first crisis they hit, GEC's centres of excellence at Preston and Stafford took a tremendous hit, and they stopped building trains in Britain as well. Now, that was partly because of the poor quality of what they were building.
Yes. 1996, Weinstock finally hangs up his boots and becomes something called the Chairman Emeritus. Basically, he's replaced by the former boss of Rover Group, I think is the correct term, the remnants of British Leyland, who had kind of feathered his cap by selling Rover Group, somewhat to everyone's astonishment, to BMW, which is another story in itself. And he comes in as a sort of new broom, doesn't he? He comes in with a plan for a new approach.
This is George Simpson, of course, and his finance director, John Mayo, who, interestingly enough, was one of the masterminds of the ICI breakup when he was a merchant banker at S.G. Warburg.
Yes.
Well, Simpson came in with this absolutely glittering CV. He pulled off this astonishing coup in offloading Rover. And then he'd had a few years at Lucas, which was then a massive auto components company employing the best part of 50,000 people. And he left it just as it was about to go into a disastrous reverse takeover with a small American company that would effectively put it out of business. But he arrived, he's seen as someone who will refocus much more on telecoms, on modern communications, on IT, all these things. It coincides with the arrival of New Labour, and before long he's been given a peerage and everything else. To begin with, it all looks rather good. But there was always an element of chance. There was a lovely quote from an analyst who said, George is the sort of person who could fall through the roof of a department store and walk out of the front door wearing a new suit. And I think the feeling was that some of this stardust would rub off on GEC. And so he then sets about disposing of viable bits of the business which don't quite fit in. And this continues until the entire business is rebranded Marconi. In the process, he uses Weinstock's £4 billion cash pile to buy a series of American companies very much in the IT...
the kind of internet space, really, isn't it?
And then, of course, just after he's done this, comes the dot-com crisis, and it turns out these companies really aren't worth anything. And by then, he hasn't just spent Weinstock's cash pile, he's borrowed fairly heavily as well.
And they're all losing money as well. So he's actually got to finance all the losses they're making.
Well, he hasn't. In the meantime, he's sold off the shipbuilding interests to BAE Systems. They've finally got out of anything to do with aircraft. And what they're left with, it lacks the critical mass of the businesses they'd had up till then.
Yes. No,
well, it's not only the critical mass. I mean, the acquisitions they made, particularly in America, were essentially throwing the money away. They were complete disasters. And as far as I can see, at the time even, it was looked pretty foolhardy. But to turn the balance sheet inside out, which is what he did, was asking for trouble, and trouble duly arrived.
So in 2001, after the crash, they kind of limp on for a bit. It seems that Simpson is sort of in denial. He doesn't want to admit to the City of London that it's all been a complete cock-up and the business is going to make a lot less money. Indeed, he's not going to make any money as opposed to the grand profits he was predicting. And so he runs up the sort of white flag in summer of 2001, admits it's all gone wrong, and he and Mayo are then pretty quickly flung out of the door. They've kind of saddled the company with a bad strategy and they're out, and it's left to the successor to try and pick up the pieces. But yeah, it just seems as the whole thing is the game is up at that point. There doesn't seem to be any way out apart from, you know, some huge stroke of luck from a big order from a customer or something to turn things around.
Much worse than that. They wiped out the shareholders of this business, which had been worth £30 billion at its peak. Not only that, they essentially wiped out the bondholders as well. So it needed a huge reconstruction and a leap of faith from the holders of debt to keep the business alive at all.
Yeah, the one thing that they still had going for them was this long-running relationship with BT as one of the suppliers of exchange equipment, switchgear equipment, and general basic electronics to the telephone system. And BT were in the process of picking the batch of contractors who would do the next lot of work. Everyone expected Marconi, as it now was, to be on that list, and it wasn't. And that really was the final straw.
Yeah. What's really telling is that the company, of course, that British Telecom decided to go with instead of Marconi was Huawei, the Chinese organization, widely regarded as not entirely safe with algorithms and backdoors. And so they, as you say, they just sort of cast BT into the wilderness. Now, of course, 20 years later, two decades later, they are basically reversing course and slinging out Huawei.
Well, that's happened so often with government procurement during that period. You cast a company aside and then suddenly realise there was no one else to do the work. And this was a theme of procurement at that period.
The other thing is that Marconi, having lost the contract, don't have a viable telephone equipment business anymore, so they sell it to Ericsson of Sweden. And of course, Ericsson of Sweden is now the company that BT is going cap in hand to replace all the components in their 5G network, which they're no longer allowed to buy from Huawei, with Ericsson. But of course, those components are not made in the UK. They are made in Estonia and Poland. So effectively, that's one of the twisty consequences of all the decisions that were taken back then.
Indeed. And of course, the other thing is that from roughly that point, Siemens began ramping up its manufacturing capacity in the UK. And you had electronic equipment, you had turbine blades, and then most recently you've had them manufacturing tube trains in Goole.
Right.
In fact, the Bakerloo line trains, which the Goole trains may ultimately replace, were made by Metro Camel, who were taken over by GEC.
And once again, a kind of complicated round trip.
But they're made in the UK.
They're made in Goole, yeah.
If you look for some sort of happy ending, there is that.
Well, they're assembled there anyway.
The profits still go back to Germany. The components come from Germany, so it is what it is. Better than nothing. So there we are. It's a pretty sad story. I mean, I think it's worth just having a bit of a sum up. I mean, I think you've certainly convinced me that this is a much more disastrous outcome than ICI in terms of, you know, involving a lot of loss of industrial capacity. It's worth maybe thinking a little bit about what that is. As you've talked about, Alstom, the French company, closed most of its UK power generation sites when it was forced into some big restructuring in 2004 and had to be nationalised. And unsurprisingly, of course, the French government being
the French government,
the users of French taxpayers' money, said, well, okay, we're going to preserve employment in France. And if that means we have to take out a few British manufacturing sites, so be it. And so that's gone. Siemens, you've mentioned, still manufactures telephone equipment in the UK, but most of its activities are in Europe or the US. And as we've said, Ericsson's manufacturing, which took over a lot of the business of that was in Marconi, is not in the UK, it's in Eastern Europe. A bit of a sad story, don't you think, Neil?
Yeah, well, it is. It's a catastrophe financially and industrially. And I would say the moral of the story is twofold. Number one, nobody should be in charge of a business for 33 years, as Arnold Weinstock was, because they are incapable of adapting to changing circumstances. And number two, it just shows if you pick the wrong person to run a business, there is no limit to the damage.
Can I just add my encomium as well? I think it goes back to something I said about ICI as well, although this clearly had much more disastrous consequences, which is a situation where you have a manager who comes in and essentially says, I'm going to tear up the structure of the business that I have, and I'm going to bet on a lot of companies which are much more valuable to the stock market. If you really boil down what George Simpson was all about, I think that was what he was about. He was like a fund manager. He picked a lot of overpriced stocks in the form of American telephone companies and tried to finance their acquisition with debt and the sale of less highly valued businesses. And what he ended up was placing an incredibly highly leveraged bet on something which turned out to be a lot of moonshine. It's an extreme case, but you see lots of cases of this in the stock market which don't have quite such dramatic outcomes but have the same fundamental dynamic. I personally have always thought that's not a good way to go about things. You should build things, not try to second guess what fund managers like the look of this week.
Yeah, stock market fashions are very fickle and should not be followed.
I don't think I disagree. George Simpson has had the humility to step back from the House of Lords. I do think this is yet another reason for not giving people honours until they have retired or until the extent of the damage they have caused is known.
The extent of the damage in this case is indeed the point. I think just a word on the sad story of Arnie Weinstock, who, as I think as Neil is right to say, he probably was beyond his sell-by date when he finally bowed out of GEC. But after the profit warning of 2001, when the full damage of his successor's strategy became clear, his stake, which had once been worth more than £400 million, was reduced to being just £2 million, and probably lower than that after what happened with BT. But of course, by 2002, he sadly died. So he wouldn't have seen the full disaster, I suppose. That's one blessing.
I think he's seen quite enough.
Yes, I think that's probably right.
That was A Long Time in Finance with Jonathan Ford and Neil Collins. Production and editing by Nick Hilton, and our sponsorship partner is briefcase.news. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review it on your podcast app, as that will help new listeners find us.